Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, last year, a hashtag became an event in Seattle. Hashtag EducationSoWhite 2017 gave voice to and started a conversation about the lack of diversity among teachers in our schools. 90% of Washington State teachers are white, while nearly half of the students are kids of color. This year, the conversation continued with a focus on how that lack of diversity influences achievement gaps and the effect of cultural divisions that separate students and teachers. The discussion also includes the added complications of gender and sexual identity issues. This hashtag EducationSoWhite 2018 event was presented by Town Hall Seattle and the Seattle Times. It took place on March 15th at Seattle University's Piggott Auditorium. KUOW's Sonia Harris recorded the conversation. We're presenting our podcast version here. To listen to the full event, go to our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Here, co-MC Christina Ju introduces the opening address.
And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our first presenter. Dr. Dawdy Abe is a Seattle-based professor who has taught and written about race, education, and hip-hop for over 20 years. He has appeared on national television such as MSNBC and The Tavish Smiley Show. He has taught students at every grade level from kindergarten through college. Another interesting fact about Dr. Abe is that today is his birthday. So please join us in giving an especially warm welcome to the stage, Dr. Dawdy Abe.
My pleasure to be here. I would say that the genesis of me standing here right now was a nice long Eastern Washington road trip that that Kristen and I participated in last fall, where we had a good 4 or 5 days over in the 509 to have some great bonding. And so it's my pleasure to be participating in this program tonight. I think I'm not going to be up here long, but I would just like to touch on a topic that's kind of foundational, I think, anyway, to what's happening throughout the evening. I wrote a dissertation about a decade ago now. That was I always have to write down the title because it's long. The effects of non-traditional instruction on the classroom discipline of African American students, grades 4 through 8, because the discipline issue was something that had come to my attention, and so why not delve into it a little bit? And so I went into it figuring like, okay, I already know what I'm going to find. I'm going to find that. You know, you have to have the things that you need to have in place are relevant curriculum that speaks to the lives of the children that you're working with, and engaging instructional methods that don't necessarily have people just sitting down and being given information that you just regurgitate. And those two things were important, but those two things finished in second and third place, far behind the number one overall factor in keeping children in classrooms. Does anybody want to take a guess at what that might have been? Personal relationships. And it reminds me of a study that I cited in that dissertation. It was called Pygmalion in the Classroom. Not sure if you've heard of it. But the basic premise went like this. This was done in the 60s. Basic premise was that researchers went into a randomly picked school, into a randomly picked classroom, and chose some randomly picked students and told the teachers of these students that these students had taken, over the summer, had taken this, I love the name of the test, it's like the Harvard test of inflected acquisition or something like that, and it was completely made up. And so the researchers told the teachers that you could expect those students who had done well to be spurters that school year. And guess what happened with those students over the course of that school year? They spurted. But here was the thing. The thing was that as the researchers were observing, they noticed that the teachers were not necessarily spending more time with the spurters than they were with the other students. So what does that tell us? That tells us that it's not about the quantity of time that teachers spend with students. It's about the quality of the interaction that makes the difference. And that kind of speaks to, that's illustrated in work that Geneva Gay at the University of Washington has done. And she had kind of a similar discussion about Native American students in Warm Springs, Oregon. And here's what she said. She said, many of the achievement problems of the students in this study derive from the interactional nature and procedural protocols of teaching rather than the substantive content of what was taught. How teachers talk to students interfered more with their academic engagement than the topics being discussed. Now, where things really start to go off the rails, I focused on grades 4 through 8 because that's where the achievement gap begins to reveal itself. But where things really start to go off the rails are not just in terms of academic achievement, but when you're also talking about discipline. And the issue within Seattle is a very pronounced one, and it is a very lengthy one, full of historical context. Here in Seattle, African-American middle school students are 3 times as likely to be suspended as other groups of students. And it's not like the district doesn't know that this is happening, and it's not like we are not working to try to fix the problem, but knowing the problem is there and being able to counteract it, especially when it's taken a long time to build up, are 2 different things. But then here's the other part here. When I did this study, I was focusing on grades 4 through 8. It has since come to my attention through further research that not only are Black middle school students being suspended at spelled at disproportionate rates, but now you have Black preschoolers being suspended and expelled at disproportionate rates. And I have to tell you that I did a parents' night at a local elementary school not too long ago and had a parent tell me that her daughter was suspended from preschool for not taking a nap. And that is funny and tragic at the same time, because before these kids even know what's happening, they are building up these files that follow you around like arrest records. And what does that then lead to? That then leads to disenfranchisement. Doing another event for the school district, I was approached by a principal after one of these things. And he talked to me about a student survey that he had conducted in his building. And it was a statement that said, what did it say? It said something along the lines of, if I am not at school, there will be an adult who misses me. And in this particular principal's school, as they broke down and disaggregated the data by race, 80% of the Black students in his school answered no. And so you start to see where the distance begins to make itself felt. And this is where we get into something I'm calling academic self-esteem, about how students view themselves as learners and whether they're smart and whether they are college material, that kind of thing. And there is definitely a through line in this dynamic as it exists now all the way up through college, because we've done work researching, once data came out at Seattle Central that Black male students were the least retained group on that campus, we started doing research on that, and it was kind of along the same lines of needing fellowship, needing support, needing resources, not feeling isolated. A lot of the things, characteristics that come up when younger kids are talking about their difficulties in connecting with their school and environment. And this is all very interesting because lots of times I hear the discussion about resilience. Like, we need to teach these children resilience. What I'm saying is, if you have been kind of, your academic self-esteem has been taking a beating since preschool, and you're still in school, to me, that's pretty resilient. You know what I'm saying? And if you're also thinking about the fact that I believe within the field, the number is maybe a little bit close to a little bit under 50% of all teachers leave the field within 5 years. Perhaps the resilience needs to be directed towards the teachers who are giving up and washing their hands of the whole situation. That's just me, I don't know. Just a couple other things before I wrap up. I just want to say that It's important to remember that just because you're a person of color does not automatically qualify you to be an excellent teacher for students of color. In my time, I have seen enough examples to prove that, no, that is not an automatic qualifier. So that is one thing too important. But at the same time, it's also important for white teachers to understand that being white is not an automatic disqualifier to be an effective teacher of students of color. I think back to my days teaching at Zion Preparatory Academy in the 1990s in middle school, and there was a coworker, a colleague of mine. Her name was, at Zion Prep, we were all brother and sister. It wasn't Mr. and Mrs. So I was Brother Dowdy, and who I'm talking about was Sister Teresa. Sister Teresa was born in West Glacier, Montana, and went to college at Kansas State University in Manhattan, Kansas. Now, I have never been to either of those places, but based on her recount of what it was like, there wasn't a whole bunch of people of color for her to interact with at either of those places. Yet she came straight into Zion, and she was tremendous with those students. And why was she tremendous? Because she was genuinely invested. She was making sure the expectations for all students were high, regardless if they met them or not, the expectations remained. And she cultivated genuine personal relationships with her students. And I don't think that I can underline that factor enough. I teach a on Wednesday nights, actually next week is our last session, version. I teach a hip-hop class at Seattle Central, but this quarter I've been teaching a version of it to students at the State Penitentiary in Monroe. And we actually had a pretty lengthy discussion, off topic, it's a hip-hop class, but I was telling them what I was doing tonight, and we had a pretty lengthy discussion about their thoughts and if they had any messages that they wanted me to pass on to you all. And in fact, yes, they do. There were many, but I think the overriding theme of what I was getting from them was that we have to be okay with saying that college is not for everybody, because that's the truth. College is not for everybody. However, we need to let the kids decide that instead of having that decision made for them by the time they're in what, middle school? Because not only around GPA, but also about how these students are feeling about themselves and whether they think they belong in college or they think they're college material. And as educators, these men were unified in their message. And this is the last thing that I'll say, is as educators, it is our responsibility to leverage these relationships in ways that help put these young people in position to decide for themselves. Education So White 2018, let's go.
Annika Anand is tonight's moderator. She is the co-founder of The Evergrey. She was previously the engagement editor with the Seattle Times Education Lab, where she worked on Under Our Skin, an interactive project that featured people from across Washington State, examining how they define terms like white privilege, racism, and colorblindness.
Right, so our first panelist, Chardonnay Beaver, is an 11th grader in Seattle, and she has helped establish two youth organizations committed to fighting racism. New Generation, which educates people about issues such as police brutality and implicit bias, and the NAACP Youth Coalition, which unites anti-racist groups across Seattle high schools into one powerful coalition.
Our next panelist is Shukri Olo. Shukri Olo was previously a project coordinator with Seattle Public Schools, where she focused on reducing chronic absenteeism and discipline for African and African American students. She currently serves on the Somali Health Board, the board for the Kent Youth and Family Services, and works with the King County.
Our next panelist, Marco Silva, lives and teaches in McAllen, Texas, on the US-Mexico border. He actually came all the way from Texas tonight. So thank you so much for being here. And he is the founder of the South Texas Ideas Festival, which is a student-led conference that is inspiring young people of the Rio Grande Valley to see their bicultural identity as an asset to their leadership potential. He's one of 30 international TED-Ed innovative educators of 2017, and he is a Bezos Educator Scholar. Please welcome Marcos.
Panelist Kristen Leong is a 2018 Citizen University Fellow and one of 30 international TED-Ed innovative educators of 2017. She is the founder of Roll Call Project, which is an international project humanizing the gaps in race, gender, and sexual orientation, separating students and teachers. Kristen is a former middle school teacher and three-term Washington State teacher leader. In addition, Ms. Leong was also my middle school teacher for humanities. I also worked with her as a teacher assistant, and she has been an amazing mentor to me. So please welcome Ms. Leong.
Our final panelist tonight is Colin Pierce. Colin is a teacher at Rainier Beach High School, where he's also the International Baccalaureate Diploma Program Coordinator. Colin is an education reform activist at the local and state policy level. He travels the country helping educators and other high poverty communities close the achievement gap by incorporating IB programs into their schools. Please welcome Colin.
And finally, please join us in giving a warm town hall welcome to our entire panel.
Thank you, Eric and Christina. That was awesome. And thank you all for being here tonight. This is a really incredible group of people that we've assembled here, and we're excited to have you all as our audience. So a few things before we start to dive in. I'd like to acknowledge first that we are on Native land, specifically the land of the Duwamish, the Puget Sound Salish, and the Lushootse tribes. So let's just take a moment to respect the space that we're in right now. Thank you. Next, I want to say that with any conversations about identity, it's really important to be cognizant of representation. That, in fact, is tonight what our entire conversation is about. So I want to acknowledge that there are a lot of people who are affected by and who care deeply about this topic that we're going to be discussing tonight who are not represented on this panel. That being said, we also don't believe that this discussion tonight stands on its own. Some of you may know that we also had an Education So White event last year. We hope to have many more of these in the future. And our goal is that each of those continue to build off of each other every single year, and that we are able to bring in different perspectives and experiences to all of these conversations over time. Also, toward the end of tonight's event, we're gonna be able to bring up the audience for questions and answers from the panelists. And we're also gonna say, invite you guys to share just thoughts and takeaways from what you hear here tonight. So even if you don't have a specific question for the panel, we're also just gonna invite you to reflect and share anything that's on your mind. And so we're hoping that's another opportunity to bring in more experiences and viewpoints to everything we discuss up here tonight. So on that note, let's get to know each other's identities a little bit better. So I'd like to know from each of our panelists, what cultures or communities do you identify with? And did you ever have teachers who shared your backgrounds? And so I'll start briefly. So I identify broadly as a straight female woman of color. Specifically, I'm East Indian. My parents were born in Kenya. My mom grew up in Canada, so I have dual citizenship. My siblings and I were raised in North Carolina, so I'm some odd combination of African, Indian, Canadian, Southern American. I never had a teacher in my K-12 or college or graduate education who shared my specific background, although I did have one Indian male professor in grad school. So that's me. Do you want to start us off, Chardonnay?
Hi, I'm Chardonnay Beaver. I identify as a straight black female. I'm also Christian, so that's my community. I think that I can count on my hand how many teachers I've had who look like me. For admin, that's different. And I'm also happy to be here tonight.
Good evening. My name is Shukri Olo. First, I wanted to give a shout out to Seattle University because I'm an alum. I went here, both undergrad and graduate school. Go Red Hawks. Red Hawk forever. That's my Wakanda forever. If you haven't seen Black Panther, go. I've seen it like 3 times and my kids were obsessed. So I think the issue of identity is a sort of a long, lifelong journey. And I've had different stages of my life where I felt like I have arrived. And I certainly haven't, probably still on that journey. But at the moment, I identify as a black Muslim woman.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Marco Silva. I come from Texas. I identify as part of the LGBT community, and I consider myself Mexican-American. I come from conservative Texas, so I don't know what teacher might have been part of the LGBT community. Definitely suspected some of them were, but none that I know of.
I'm Kristen. I identify as biracial. I am half Chinese and half white. I am also part of the LGBTQ community. And I was thinking about this question. I don't think I have ever had an Asian or mixed race teacher in my whole K through 12 or in college or in graduate school, ever. And I did have gay and lesbian professors in college, but I didn't have any out teachers when I was K through 12.
Colin Pierce, by way of answering this question, I'm gonna tell just a quick story, which is that I told my students today that I was doing this, and they told me that I should start with a joke. And so I was like, okay, well, I'll try this one out on you. Like before I joined the panel, the event was called Education Kinda White. they did not laugh, which is why I decided not to tell it tonight.
But now you're getting laughs, so you've really just.
But I identify as white, male, cisgender, straight. I grew up in Oakland, California, and there's some Oakland in the house. I love it. Okay, exciting. Rockridge. Oh, Rockridge, I love it too. Look at that. I've already got a crowd here. So yeah, grew up in Oakland, California. That is a big part of my identity as well. But like since I've moved to Seattle, the Rainier Beach community, the South End, my school is pretty deep in my sense of identity.
Awesome. Yeah, and so I'll also remind all of our panelists up here tonight, I'll be asking everybody here questions, but would love for you guys to jump in and make this feel like much more of a conversation and discussion. And I'm going to actually start with Chardonnay because in my short time in education reporting, I learned how valuable it was to bring in student voices in everything that we do. And so I'm really, really excited that we have Chardonnay's perspective and voice here tonight. And so as a student of color who's been able to connect with at least one teacher of color at your high school, as we talked about before this panel, can you share with us what feels different or significant about your relationship with that teacher of color versus other teachers who are white at your school?
I think it's the advocacy portion that really impacts me and influences me. Somebody you can go to who isn't going to question you based off what you say, or you don't have to psychologically question, is he saying this or is she saying this because I'm black? Is he saying this, is she saying this because I'm a female? You know, people of color, speaking from my own experience, that's always a thing, you know, instances of that sort. And so going to somebody who you can talk to and like, oh, you know, having those cultural interactions, like, did you see Black Panther? Me too. You know, like that, yes, it was amazing. Did you get that message? Yeah. Like things of that sort is really awesome. For many students, I know I go to Garfield, that's like a safe haven. It's like a place that you can go to and, you know, chill and relax, but also admire and inspire to be similar to that person and get those components of education that you can receive differently.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And Colin, I'm curious, as a white teacher, what are you doing to try to address that kind of disconnect that Chardonnay is talking about? Or is it possible? You know, what do you do to try to make your classroom feel like a more inclusive place for all of your students?
Yeah, here's a story as well, which is about how naive I am. And that is, having grown up in Oakland, having attended diverse schools when I was growing up, I was like, oh, I got this in the bag, right? Like, of course, like this is in me. This is like, of course, how insulated and how thick my blinders were to the level of privilege that I had experienced. And also I think the false impression that a lot of white folks get that underneath any colored skin is just a good white person waiting to get out, right? Like, in fact, there are very important differences that are there to be celebrated, right? And that involve us not necessarily saying, you know, like, I'm colorblind, etc., but more like, okay, well, what and who are you, and how do you see yourself, and being receptive to that. But a piece of advice that I got going into teaching in a low-income school was just two things: out love them and outlast them. And you know, you get this question a lot, do you care if your students like you? I've heard it on job interviews and that sort of thing. And honestly, it's like, I don't care. What I care about is if I like them, right? Like, do I care about them? Am I coming in wanting to give them something valuable every day? And if I'm in that position, then the rest of it's gonna kind of fall into place. The other piece is, I think we as teachers, and this is both a very Western and a very male-oriented approach to things, but we value certainty, right? Like, we value answers, we value being right, and a lot of the structures that we have within education are centered around that, right? Like, do you have the answer? Did you give the right answer? All of that sort of thing. Rather than, like, a receptive place, a place of questioning, an inquisitive place. And I think that particularly because, you know, you're probably more likely to become a teacher if you've had a really positive experience in your schooling. So the people who end up in the teaching profession are often people who did have that very, like, answer-oriented, certainty-oriented, not necessarily receptive orientation in their education. And so I think that it perpetuates itself. And as such, like, how do I, as an educator, model not just that receptivity, but also create a classroom space where that receptivity is valued, encouraged, where being wrong about something is not a problem. In fact, it's something to be celebrated. And then the other piece is, like, vulnerability, and being vulnerable. And, like, the students of mine who are in the audience will know that I, like, make an ass of myself on a regular basis in class. In fact, my colleagues probably know that too. I'm saying right now, it's totally intentional. It's all an instructional strategy. But I do think, though, that, like, you know, there's so much that Dr. Abe talked about that I think is relevant here as well, particularly regarding taking a strengths-based as opposed to a deficit-based approach, building in opportunities for students to feel successful before you ask them to do something hard, right? So that they're not already struggling against those years and years of internalized sense of inferiority as well. So, that's all of that.
Can I sort of respond to that? And I think I want to also respond to something that Dr. Abe mentioned about being a white educator doesn't necessarily disqualify you from being an effective teacher. And growing up, so I came to this country at the age of 10 as a refugee from Kenya. I was born in Mogadishu, Somalia. Shout out to Somalis. It's not that many of us. I see you. Sort of a very homogeneous refugee camp that we lived in and airdropped in the middle of nowhere in Houston, Texas in 96 in a very difficult environment. And we fled to Washington State. I say fled because, like, it was extremely hard at that time, and it feels like a different...
I know what you're talking about.
He knows what I'm talking about. Yeah. Yes, Marcos. You live there. and we came to Washington State and had my first experience with this white educator in the sixth grade, refugee kids who didn't speak any English, and Miss Kelly. Miss Kelly was this really kind white woman who knew that our widowed mother didn't speak any English, worked 2 to 3 jobs, was basically surviving, taking care of 3 children on her own. And Miss Kelly would make sure that we had access to services because she knew that my mom couldn't help, she couldn't navigate those systems. And she would make us stay during recess, and at the time I hated her for that. But in hindsight, the time that we stayed in doing our homework with her support meant a lot, and it showed that like she cared. And that's getting to the point about teachers don't necessarily have to always reflect the identity of that child, as long as that teacher is loving on that child, and that child knows that. And Dr. Abe mentioned about the research in, I don't know how long ago it was, but in the 60s or somewhere, that says an adult that has one positive interaction with a child can change that child's trajectory. And Miss Kelly, in the sixth grade in Kent, Washington, was that for me, a black child who's never had any experience with folks outside of my ethnic or racial background. And she was that for me. And there are plenty of teachers like Miss Kelly, like Colin, who are that for many other students as well.
Are you still in touch with Miss Kelly?
I am.
Aww.
Hopefully she's watching tonight.
I wanted to touch on something that you said, and also on something that Dr. Abe said, and that's around like loving and expectations, and what that looks like. Because I think, you know, there was a lot of talk about expectations when I first came, you know, when I was going through my education as a teacher, and I think that I thought, in fact, I know that I thought that high expectations was just sitting there privately having those thoughts in your head, right? And I was like, oh, that's not going to work. Like, that's not going to work at all. And it took me a little while to recognize that, like, that loving wasn't about making excuses, that loving wasn't about sort of recognizing structures of oppression and giving students a pass because of those, right? That it was actually about saying, you know what, in this space, failure is not an option. Like, you don't get to back down in the ways that you, the sort of like easy way out the back door, all of that that you may have been given before is not an option for you. And so we're gonna hold you here, and we're gonna make sure that we find a path to success one way or the other. And it took me a while to figure out how you start building that into the classroom, and how it's less about necessarily the expectation, but it is, you develop that relationship so that you're able to say that. You're able to say that without without threatening the student as well.
I totally agree. I think that teachers are to be nurturers. Like, I spend majority of my day with my teacher, and I come home to my family, and that little bit of access of time, now that I'm in high school, people who are in high school can understand you have no time to yourself. but no, you spend a lot of that time with your teacher, and they're supposed to nourish you and get to know you. And I think that if those needs aren't being met, the student's gonna do other things to reach that point. And just not stepping back. Having a teacher I have a teacher who's white, Mr. Leslie, love him. He has done an incredible job incorporating my history into the units, every unit. And at times I've questioned, is this too much of my history? Because I'm so used and constructed to a westernized curriculum. And having that and him knowing when to step back and step forward and advocate is so essential to the classroom environment and what students are gonna put out and the energy that they bring to the classroom.
And Marcos, you have a really unique experience here as well. Do you wanna talk about that?
Yeah, I kinda wanna add to that. So being here is really, really special to me. So I grew up migrant. My parents came into this country in 1990s, and they really came because they were needing a lot of field workers in the north part of Washington. And so I spent the beginning part of my schooling in schools here. I really experienced what it was to be the only kid of color. And actually before I came back, I was going through pictures that my mom kept and report cards. And there was one report card in the back that said, Marcos would benefit from reading in the summer. And you know, I was put in a position in where I had to be my own advocate at a young age, translating from Spanish to English for my parents. You can imagine I didn't read that summer because my mom really didn't get that note. I was in charge of telling her that I needed to read in the summer. But now that I teach, now that I teach in a community where I was raised and 92% of the people in my community look the same, I understand the teacher relationship with students, but I also really value the teacher relationship with parents. I think that that's really important. I've had students, because we all look alike, the area that I live in, it's in the southmost tip of the state, and we have the border right next to Mexico, that is the river, the Rio Grande River, but then 60 miles north of us, we have the Border Patrol checkpoint. And so we house a lot of first-generation Americans. And a lot of our stories are the same. You know, parents came into this country for a better opportunity. You know, the parents that bring their kids over here, they look at education as a privilege. And so a lot of my job really is, yes, to connect to students, but also to educate parents about the expectations of being a parent in America, and the expectations between the relationship that we're both going to have. And so I think that that's also really, really important.
Yeah. I was struck, Marcos, you and I were talked before, and you said that when you are in parent-teacher conferences with your students' parents, that it feels like you're just hanging out with your mom's friends and your aunties, right? And the conversation goes back and forth between Spanish and English. And I thought about how, like, empowering that is for those families to have you as a link to their child, right? I mean, teachers were with kids sometimes. Chardonnay, you probably know, like, more sometimes than they even see their families. They're with their school teachers. And so, like, that's the power of having teachers that not only look like the families, look like the students they serve, but look like their families as well.
Teaching is really like, I didn't understand how political teaching was. We have the power to really put in front of kids what we want. And I think that that's really important, because I go back to what you were saying, like, these culturally relevant lessons are very impactful for kids of color. You know, yes, the majority of teachers in America are white, meaning a lot of kids of color will never see a teacher represented, themselves represented as a teacher, but that also means that a lot of white kids will never see a teacher of color as the knowledge holder. And so it's really important to recognize that and build our education around that.
I actually meant to, I forgot to say that in the introduction because I didn't answer that part of the question. It's like, well, yeah, like, of course I had a lot of teachers that looked like me. But I also, like, I have multiple memorable teachers of color that I had, and I think that they were really my first intimate interactions with someone from a different background than myself, right? And that made a huge change. And I think that while we often forget that there is very important social justice work to be done in white and affluent schools, and that not necessarily prioritizing that above or anywhere, you know, like in any hierarchy, but that part of that is making sure that they have that experience as well.
Yes, we've talked about the impact of having teachers of color, you know, in terms of the student relationships, parent relationships, also with other teachers, right? Feeling like if you are a teacher of color or from a community that's less represented at your school, it can be very lonely sometimes. So, Kristen, I wonder if you could talk about that experience a little bit.
Yeah, so it's not just the race gap, right? Like, it's also the gender gap, that by far the majority of our teachers are women, and of course about half of our students are boys. Our visibility of our transgender students is on the rise. And it's also sexual orientation. So we don't have data about how many LGBTQ students and teachers are out there, right? We're just starting to understand how valuable it is to collect that data. But in the meantime, we do see students more and more identifying as somewhere on a spectrum, right? Acknowledging that they're perhaps not 100% heterosexual or 100% homosexual, but somewhere in between. And meanwhile, it's still unsafe in a lot of places for LGBTQ teachers to be out. And so, you know, you talk about that loneliness of students perhaps not seeing themselves in their teachers. There's also that loneliness for teachers who are teachers of color, perhaps the only one in their school, or LGBTQ teachers who are perhaps the only one in their school, or maybe they're not the only one, but nobody can be out. So you don't even know, right? And so, I think we're just starting to think, I think we're ready to have this conversation about the race gap, right? Like our title of our event, like people are ready for that hashtag and we're ready to be here tonight. I think we are just starting to be ready to think about how do we also create inclusive schools for our queer students. And then I think the next step is then thinking about how do we create inclusive schools for our queer teachers. And then of course thinking about then how do we also support our teachers and students who are both queer and of color. I remember there was a story at once, there's a student, a high school student that I had had as a middle schooler. Our school was 6 through 12, and he was having lots of challenges with his decision making. And teachers and counselors were kind of, you know, discussing this student and thinking about what could be done and discussing all the things that had been tried and weren't working and, you know, staff room conversations, and I just piped in and I was like, well, is anybody like talking to him about the fact that he's gay and like none of his friends are gay and like he's not dating and all the rest of his friends are dating? And it was like, like the record, like I just said what you're not supposed to say. And then I was like, oh, like, are we not acknowledging that? Like, is that not a thing? And then I realized like the burden that I think teachers of color that we talk about frequently about the fatigue of always having to advocate for inclusive curriculum, books that are not just about straight white boys, are, you know, that teachers of color are largely tasked with connecting with and also disciplining our students of color. That it's also, if you're a teacher of color and also queer, then are you also now tasked with advocating for all of your LGBTQ students on top of that? And so when we talk about the burnout rate of teachers, and that we look at that, that it's higher for our teachers of color, I would suspect it's also higher for our queer teachers as well. You know, so that's why it's so important that we need allies who are white and straight to be doing this work too.
Can I comment on sort of the exodus of black and brown teachers out of the education workforce? One of the reasons is because of what you mentioned, Kristen, about being the only teacher of color in your school and being put on to staff the race and equity team. Does that sound familiar?
You're like, are the team, what? Like just you, because you're the only
like
teacher of color?
One black person always, like always, which is fine. And having to like be the voice of reason, like what are those kids thinking, or what is that community thinking, or what is that parent thinking when that other educator could also just ask that student or like ask the parent, like, what are your needs? How can I support you? I'm not a historian, but I was reading up most recently, and I read that there in the South with segregation, black children were being taught by black teachers. And with integration, all of those teachers were fired. And in the state of Washington, in Seattle, with integration, a lot of the black teachers were not hired, right? And so we now are trying to bring back a workforce that has experienced decades of institutional and structural racism, that has experienced a lot of the trauma that we see our black and brown children going through right now, whether it's discipline. And I worked on a Race to the Top grant for Seattle Public Schools that was trying to reduce chronic absenteeism and discipline for African and African American students in the Southeast. Those teachers may not come back, right? Because the trauma that they experienced as children is too much. And the trauma of having to navigate the same system that brought them to that level of trauma is too much. And then you add in all these other components of, you know, OSPI wants this standardized testing, and now the school board is coming up with this new policy change. Oh, and by the way, you're losing teaching, you know, staff. And, you know, I have two kids in the Kent School District, and they lost 100 positions. That's a lot. And I wonder how many of those positions are positions that were held by staff of color. And so how do you then bring back a workforce that we've neglected, that we told were unwanted, that we put through decades and decades of institutional racism? I don't know if a flyer that they saw from a college of education, university, as great as it is gonna do the job. Like, that's not enough. I want us to be thinking about not necessarily the current sort of the workforce that we want to get, which is great, but what's your role as an educator now? How are you creating that teacher who's gone through that trauma for decades? How are you, you know, managing your classroom in a way that you're able to check your bias, right? Like, that discipline rates exist for a reason, and it's often because of implicit or explicit bias, right? We're treating kids differently based on their race, period. How are you checking that one colleague who is white, who says whatever, and no one is able to say anything to that person, and their microaggressions, and consistently disrespecting parents, perhaps, kids, perhaps? There are things that you can do in the everyday as an educator, and I feel like we need more focus on that.
Colin, I think, brought up earlier that the people who are likely to go into teaching are people that had positive experiences in school. And so, like, it is essential. If we want more teachers of color, we need to have our kids of color have more positive experiences in our schools.
Yeah, and I'm curious what kinds of conversations are happening in the schools you guys are in now to get at what Shukri is talking about, right? If any, either the conversations that are happening or the conversations you wish were happening.
I'm gonna, again, conservative Texas. I was actually approached by another teacher, really excited, because he was starting the Gay Straight Alliance. And I was the only person, and the first person he told. And it was he was expecting a reaction. He was expecting a congratulations, a man, you're changing the way. And then it was like, so what do I do now? And it was a moment of, you know, in Texas, we're not ready for those conversations. And it's sad. And, you know, I had one of my students who I had for about 3 years come up to me, and she stops me in the middle of the sidewalk and says, I want to ask you something, but I'm really scared and I don't want to be disrespectful. Being gay, you know what that question is. We spent about 5 minutes with her saying, you know, it's just we're all wondering, but we don't know how to say it. We really like you, but we kind of want to know because we've always expected. And you know, back home, it's still a respect thing. It's still you don't ask, you don't share, and it's you're not supposed to have those conversations with students yet. So that's, you know, that's really important. The other thing I kind of want to mention, ACT sent out a report a couple of years ago, and out of all the students that they were taking the ACT, obviously going into college, 75% of the kids that checked off that they're going into education or getting an education degree were white. And so our future kind of still looks like what it's looking like today. And so I'm going to go back. I think that culturally relevant lessons are really what we need to focus on right now.
And just to follow up on what you're saying, Marcus, what, if anything, do you feel comfortable kind of spurring more of those conversations at your school? Like, what would it take for you to feel like you could really talk openly with people about your concerns and, you know, how they're feeling about representation?
So I'm gonna shout out the Bezos Foundation because they've really supported me in starting a project with one of my students. In where we're tackling the conversation about culture, community, and identity. Again, 92% of my community looks the same, but we all don't have the same idea of what it is to be ourselves down there. You know, we live in a pocket of America that a lot of people don't really understand, and the foundation has really helped us spark these conversations with kids. So what we do is we put community leaders in front of young adults, not to talk about their jobs, but to talk about being a female CEO that reports to a male board. And I think for me, what it's doing is it's getting our kids to really recognize the community that they're from and how they've been brought up. You know.
Yeah. So like. For the South Texas Ideas Festival, you guys are so deliberate about curating really diverse speaker lineups. You have speakers talking about LGBTQ issues. Yeah. You have speakers talking about what it means to be a leader as a woman. Like in Seattle, like we take that for granted. Like that's what we do. We seek out diversity, right? We're proud allies in so many different public events. But like in South Texas, like are you seen as sort of like a troublemaker, like a revolutionary? Like what is it like? because you are starting these conversations right in McAllen on the border.
So I do this outside of school. I should have said that. This event does not happen on campus. But we're trying to have those conversations. We're trying to put students in those positions at a younger age because 100%, my job is to send 100% of my students off to college. 25% of those have to go to a tier one, tier two university, which means they have to leave our community to attend college. And what that does is it puts a student who's never been outside of our community in a different environment. And I want to make sure that they can navigate those conversations.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. This Education So White 2018 event was presented by Town Hall Seattle and the Seattle Times. It took place on March 15th at Seattle University's Piggott Auditorium. KUOW's Sonia Harris recorded the conversation. You can hear the full event on our website, kuow.org/speakersforum. Stay current with us by subscribing to our podcast. We appreciate your likes and comments. Tune in again soon.